Thank you for joining us today for Volume 3 of our artist interview series, Articulations. This program is a collaboration between the Margaret Slaw Center for Women and Gender Equity and KHOI 89.1 FM. My name is Nancy Gebhardt, and we are thrilled to introduce you to four amazing artists in our community, from whom you'll hear every Monday at 4 p.m. during the month of March. This is the first interview in this volume of the series, and I am excited to be speaking with Catherine Reinhardt. Catherine is an interdisciplinary artist from Ames. She creates fiber work and conducts social practice with abandoned textiles around themes of labor, connection, and care. She received her MFA in textiles from the University of Kansas and a BFA in integrated studio arts at Iowa State. Reinhardt exhibits locally, nationally, and internationally. Her artworks are in collections at the University of Mississippi and Kyoto Kaika University in Kyoto, Japan. Reinhardt is the recipient of numerous grants and residencies, including the Iowa Arts Council, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Aramont School of Arts and Crafts. Reinhardt was recently honored as a 2020 Iowa Artist Fellow, a 2021 Terrain Exhibitions Artist in Residence in Springfield, Illinois, a recipient of the Alex Brown Foundation's Artist in Residence in Des Moines, Iowa, and an Artist in Residence at the West Cork Art Center in Ireland. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, Nancy. Great to be here.
How are you?
I'm good.
I'm so glad to be talking with you. And you're an artist, a local artist that I followed for a long time and have always valued our interactions, and especially just the things that I've learned from you and how you share your art online and in all different spaces. And so I'm really excited to spend this time talking with you. So just in that long bio, you're a very busy artist, obviously. But one of the things that I think people connect to your art is definitely your connection to textiles. Mm-hmm. That's obviously influenced by your graduate education as well, but you also cover a wide range of media, including performance and social practice art. But the thread that I really see and I find so interesting across all your work is that ethic of care. So can we start there and talk a little bit about how care informs the artwork that you make?
Yeah, I mean, I think inherent in textiles, because it's such a sort of delicate medium, if you're going to choose, you know, to make art with fabric and textiles, it's not as archival as, say, sculpture. So I do feel like there's a larger burden of care in making and showing and exhibiting textile artwork. But also, I think really, I'm really interested in care just within, like, because of my experiences.
Sure.
So, for example, when I was in my 20s, I did a lot of non-medical home care for the elderly. So a lot of caregiving for the elderly and disabled. And then for the past 10 years, I've sort of also been working as a stay-at-home mom and a professional artist at the same time, which I love doing. You know, and both motherhood and art making and sort of elder care are a lot about these repetitive, consistent actions that provide comfort, and they connect us with one another, right? They demonstrate care or love. And I see a lot of that same sort of thing in the processes that I am drawn to in textile art. So a lot of stitching by hand, a lot of using abandoned materials and then sort of giving them a new life in a gallery or a museum. And I think that demonstrates a lot of care for things that are forgotten or discarded, or, you know, giving things sort of a second look or a second chance. And so, I don't know.
I think that's great. Just like talking about how all those different experiences that you have, right? Individual experiences, artistic experiences, mothering experiences, and how they really all do come together in your art. And one thing I think that's always drawn me to your work is that I feel that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's care, right? You feel care. Mm. It's not always a tangential thing, but it's an emotional thing. And I'm not exactly sure that I can articulate how it comes through in your work, but it's, you know, it's the time. You can feel time, you can feel patience, you can feel softness, you can feel all different things like that when it comes through. I guess even what you were describing too is like this kind of repetition. It made me think of most recently I got to see one of your performance works in Des Moines. It was a few months ago when you were at the Alex Brown Foundation. Can you talk a little bit about that performance? Because for me, that's what really, me and my daughter, when we talked about it, it was this, the beauty and also kind of monotony, right, of repetition.
Yeah, so this performance, and I want to say I'm not a performance artist, but I do periodically do performance, it seems like once every decade. I feel the need to do a performance.
Could you explain that a little bit too? Like, what was it that made you want to do this particular thing as a performance?
Yeah, when I do performance, it's almost always about grief or loss. And it usually involves hair, like human hair of some kind, or like I think a lot of fiber. Mm-hmm. It references hair and the body too. The performance was called Bundles and Burdens. And so it was a durational performance that lasted 2 or 3 hours. And it consisted of me in this darkened room where I walked in. I got undressed and dressed in sort of a uniform, a pink jumpsuit, sort of referencing maybe work in a factory or some sort of like labor uniform. Mm-hmm. And I consider it kind of like a domestic uniform, perhaps, or a studio uniform. And then I sat down in this darkened room with one spotlight above me. And then for the 2 hours, I continuously and methodically wrapped small bundles of my son Matthew's hair. Mm-hmm. Using tools actually from fly fishing, all these wonderful, scissors and spools of thread and bits of copper wire that were sourced from my home, from my sort of domestic landscape, and then actually were sourced from Mainframe Studios, which mm-hmm. is where I was doing the performance. They were renovating, so I do that a lot. I kind of scavenge for abandoned materials. Sure. And then in whatever site or place I'm at, and then combine the materials from my home and the clippings from my son's hair, which I've been saving since he was a child, and his hair grows so fast and it's abundantly curly.
Yeah.
And so this performance was literally just me tying these little bundles of hair for a long time. I don't think I even looked at the audience. And so it was a calming atmosphere. The whole performance also really centers around the rituals and rhythms of caretaking. Mm-hmm. And also, I was thinking a lot about the small accumulation of loss that gathers in motherhood. And this can take many forms. I think motherhood has large losses if you lose a child. Mm-hmm. If, you lose relationship with your child or other parts of your family, you know, there are big losses. But there are also losses like loss of identity when you become a mom, loss of... physical loss in giving birth and raising a child, and the demands of breastfeeding or sleepless nights. You know, I feel like there's a lot of loss of capacity, loss of agency maybe, or loss of circumstance, or maybe what you thought your life was going to look like.
Yeah.
What surprised me about the performance as well was, at the same time as all these losses exist, and it's hard to count them, mm-hmm. there are also a lot of joys that come when you are paying attention. And I know I can miss a lot when I don't pay attention, but when I was wrapping these little bundles of hair, I started to notice, oh, I love how the hair twists that way, or like, I like the way the sound these tools make when I'm cutting the thread. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, something went really wrong. I have to like problem solve, you know, and there was a lot of like moments of joy and a kind of accomplishment as well, which was really interesting. I had a lot of good responses from that performance. I especially connected with lots of other mothers and had some really great conversations, which is always what art should be doing.
Yeah. So. Well, I got to experience it with my daughter and sitting next to your children, which was a really wonderful way to experience it. And I remember spending a lot of my time just watching the three kids watch you, right? Mm. And I really loved that kind of level of looking at it. And I would say for us, for my daughter and I, the little moments of joy especially came from after you would wrap a bundle of hair and you would drop it into a ceramic dish. Mm-hmm. It would make this beautiful little tink.
Oh, yes. That was one of my favorite parts, too.
It was such a wonderful sound. Yes. In there was just the pitch, the tone, the timing, you know, how it you knew that to expect it too. So you were almost like looking forward to it. And then you would hear that little, just that little sound at its such a joyful kind of expression in the performance.
Oh, so, that's true.
Yeah. So well, I was thinking about an earlier conversation we had where you were talking about, I think you had discussed a book that you were reading and how it made you think differently about work as a, and comparing it to the idea of tending, right? And how does this connect to the idea of care?
Yeah. And actually, I'm just going to read a portion of that book because sure. I love it so much. And I actually come back to it a lot when I'm wanting to reground myself in the work of, you know, art and the work of caregiving in general. This is from the author Rebecca Solnit from her essay titled Landscapes of Emergency. And I'll just read a little excerpt from it.
That'd be great.
It's the third section titled Attending, quotations. Work generates. Labor maintains. Work has disappeared into fragments. Labor has rarely been honored and hardly recognized. It took and takes place in the realm of the female, the domestic, the rural, the private. It maintains and is marginalized with the body. Tending, a word that means to care for, after all, is connected to the word attending, which means to pay attention to and to wait.
I love that.
I do too.
Yeah, I can tell by your reaction to how much those words mean to you. So I'm glad that you shared them with us.
Yeah. And I think I love just setting words next to each other or doing sort of like a deep dive into the history of the language, you know, because you learn like tending to care for, mm-hmm. attending, mm-hmm. to pay attention. And I think what's important about care, and I don't know if this answers the question you asked me, but and the importance of art in our society is it really shifts what people are paying attention to, you know, through the lens of the artistic eye, right? Which is the gift that artists can give to a society to sort of like switch the lens. And this can vary based upon what the artist is interested in or what the artist sees in the world, you know? And so it sort of shifts that perspective of tending, which has tied up in it caring as well.
Absolutely.
You know, and sort of a empathetic, when we pay attention to something, we're sort of automatically more compassionate towards whatever that something is, mm-hmm. which is a beautiful way to like exist and to interact in the world, I think.
I think that's a wonderful way to kind of attach it also just to the broader purpose and kind of representation of artists in our communities. And I think if you think and look back on anything historically, a lot of times what you'll look at is what were the artists doing, right? What were they making? What were they paying attention to? And how does that teach us about what was happening during that time period, whatever it may be? But that still applies. I love thinking about it, how you're saying it, like, to this moment now, like, how do we decide what to pay attention to? Right.
Yeah.
And it's this reminder to be present where so often maybe we're not able to, whatever it may be, but
yeah. And our society is obsessed with, busyness and productivity, and we've forgotten how to pay attention really to some really disastrous kind of effects. I think that happens all through history, right?
Yeah.
And artists are, I remember reading a book about and calling artists cultural producers instead of this sort of genius artist or something, generators of culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about your media choices. So you made one comment earlier about that textiles are not as archival as, say, sculpture. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit more. But because even in our short interview so far, we've talked about textiles, we've talked about performance, we've talked about even how you scavenge for materials, right, and connect it to the place where you are. How do you make decisions about what media to use for a particular project?
Well, it's really an intuitive process. One thing that sort of influenced me starting to use abandoned textiles or thrifted quilts or sort of domestic objects was, I got out of graduate school and my husband went into graduate school. And so we had no money.
Yeah.
And in the Midwest, quilts and like embroideries or all these domestic textiles, they're so ubiquitous and they're really cheap because you can find them at estate sales. Same with like thread. I used just a lot of thread and I was scavenging ends from weaving. Contacted my professors and say, the stuff you throw away, can I have that? just because, I didn't have a lot of money to make art.
Mm-hmm.
Basquiat did his paintings on cardboard that he found in New York Street.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one of the ways I started. And then I find that, I don't use everything I make. Things just kind of, I'm drawn to specific things. I have a pile of old maps from the Iowa State Map Library that doesn't exist anymore that I've had for 15 years or something, probably longer.
And that you move from house to house or
and
studio
to
studio.
A lot of stuff I get in, given to me, and then I end up giving away some of it and keeping others. And then, my process is really intuitive, so I'll be reading something or read a poem or I see something and then I'm making something over here and they somehow connect. Usually it's driven by conceptual concerns or like a conceptual theme or idea like motherhood or mapping or this idea of invisible labor. Where does that exist and how can we bring more attention to these overlooked things.
I do remember relating to motherhood. I do remember a point when you were asking people to save and give you the bits of Hatchimal eggs, which is something I don't know that people that do not have young children, understand. But it made me laugh when you asked just because for so many years, I would clean up all of these little bits of Hatchimal eggs.
Yes. And it's like paying attention to what's around and how could that be new forms for art? I think historically, artists also being mothers is really frowned upon. I read an article in Hyperallergic and the title was, is motherhood the last taboo in art? Tracy Emin is really sort of famous for saying like, oh yeah, there's famous artists who have kids. They're men. They're called men, and she decided not to have children and she's a very successful artist. And, but I'm more interested in the potential for the domestic life to have new forms of art making, mm-hmm. right? What works of contemporary art can we make from looking at our homes? And the pandemic really, I think, collapsed our work and home life in a way that maybe will make that possible, more possible or yeah. more accepted. So yeah, sometimes with me and materials, it's really happenstance.
Sure.
Right.
Maybe it goes back to what you were saying too, of just paying attention, right? Yeah. Like that those two things are connected, and that's part of where the intuitive feeling comes from, is from paying attention.
Yeah. And I get excited when things can relate. So like, for example, I was working with all of these maps at a residency, and then I started to see like topographical formations or those abstract shapes of mountains, you know, and the elevation lines everywhere, mm-hmm. like in my home.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that. Those leggings, those dirty leggings on the floor look like a geological formation, you know? And so it's interesting, you know, how looking at different things can even just shift your perspective on things you see every day, which is exciting to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and how do we, how can we combine things that really don't have references for each other into artwork?
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Absolutely. And I think you touched on something too, of just the presence of textiles and quilt making and embroidery, especially in your experience growing up in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And potentially, do you see that as a way to connect to other people, right? Or to take something that is seen as ordinary and then allow people a different way of looking at it.
Right. Yeah. And that's the beauty of textiles for me in its use in contemporary art, because I feel like textiles are such a good bridge to people who aren't interested in art, which is like my whole family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't say that. They're supportive, but I am the only artist in a whole family of like diesel mechanics and milkmen.
Yeah.
And, you know, who grew up in rural Iowa. And so, and I make contemporary art, you know, that could be kind of alienating to them, honestly. And the artists I like, they often like don't really understand, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because I love those people in my life, I want them to love art in general. And I just want more art to exist in the world. And I think I'm happy to use textiles to make art more accessible to people, because textiles have been described as a second skin, right? We are so familiar with clothing ourselves, with putting blankets on our bed to comfort us, to keep us warm, to keep us protected. They're such a vital part of how we exist and mm-hmm. thrive in the world, and we just don't pay attention to them, really.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of things that are very close to us. And so, I continually in art galleries, you know, hear, you know, curators, people just want to touch fiber art, you know, there's a really instinctive, and it's really hard to keep them from doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And which is, you know, a complicated issue, but I also do this sort of socially engaged art where we repair quilts together. And that is a really nice way where I can say, yes, please touch this.
Yes.
These quilts were unwanted and abandoned, and you are adding your value and your time and your labor. We're doing that together. And then they'll eventually be art objects. And I think there's something really powerful in that transformation process too. So
absolutely. And giving them that opportunity to have that tactile experience.
To touch.
Yeah. I remember a few years ago, I worked on an exhibition with Priscilla Sage, another local textile artist. And she did these hanging textile sculptures. And during installation, she said, she's like, no, I want people to come up and spin them. And I was like, sorry.
we can't
really do that.
Yeah, right.
But it was because, and she anticipated it, right? That people wanted to touch them because of, there's just something that's inherent about their texture, the way, maybe because of the physical closeness we have to textiles, there's a familiarity that seems like permission, right? To access them in that way. And so, I was just thinking about that as you were talking about just this, I think our connection, right? To the material itself. You talked a little bit, I want to go back to talk about how you were saying in your home, you started seeing like the leggings or the piles of dirty clothes and, you know, whatever it may be as these landscapes and connected to your interest in mapping. Mm-hmm. And so you created a series called The Topography of Dwelling,
yes.
Right? And that's kind of all bringing those things together. Can you tell us a little bit more about that series?
Yeah, this series spans various media, lots of fiber work, sculpture, performance. I've probably been doing this series since 2018, 2020. I started doing a lot of work in the topography of dwelling in 2020.
Mm-hmm. As we were, like you were saying, our work and home life were collapsing.
Yeah. And really, this is approaching my home as sort of an archivist and a laborer, as an artist and a mother. And I have these questions, sort of driving questions. And one of them is, how can I, as an artist, borrow methods from anthropology to map and archive domestic spaces? So when I started the series, The Topography of Dwelling, I really tried to take it or look at my domestic space from the lens of an anthropologist or an archaeologist, and all those sites that we sort of treasure, you know, these dig sites, these ancient civilizations, you know, we carry off the artifacts and put them in museums, and they're sort of treasured cultural, historical artifacts. Those were all just homes.
Mm.
They're someone's homes or village, and we learn a lot about the people there. And so I was like, well, what if I apply the same eyes to my current space?
Yeah.
And what if we could map or archive current domestic spaces? You know, what would survive in 300 years? It might be those damn like Hatchimal eggs, or like certainly pots. And, mm-hmm. you know, tools, you know, have survived millennia when our bodies have not,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, like, maybe it would be my kids' broken toys.
Yeah.
And that's what future archaeologists would have to decipher how we lived. I was at the terrain residency. It was by this historic house in Springfield, Illinois, where Lincoln had once lived, I think. I hope that got that right. But what they were archiving, a privy, which is like the outside toilet.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who were digging said they learned so much by what they threw in the privy.
Wow.
Like the household threw away toothbrushes. But at the time, only wealthy people had toothbrushes,
sure.
This certain kind of toothbrush. And so they learned about class. They learned about status, social standing, you know, by essentially the trash that we produce.
Wow.
So it was interesting to learn about that. And then like, oh, look at my home, about what kind of trash might define me? Or like, what would these things that I overlook in my current home, how would I map them or archive them? Another great story I have about documenting or archiving that I ran across was, there was a farmer who noticed that the swallows would come and return every year and roost in his barn. And he loved this sort of migration. And so what he did is he made notes on the ceiling of his barn on the like wooden trellises or whatever they're called. And he noted the date and the time every year for 30 years when the swallows would return.
Wow.
Right? Which is a sort of a biological, a biologist or an ornithologist would be very interested also in how to track that. But he was just a farmer marking time,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I'm also interested in, you know, my grandfather had a farm journal that he wrote down, like, how many sows there were and piglets. And, mm-hmm. you know, I looked at that while I was trying to figure out, like, why do we keep certain information? What, and kind of mundane information too, maybe. Yeah. And what's its significance? And
yeah, and what gets saved, and how does that inform what we know, right? Or what we think, or how we experience the world. There's
right.
a lot of really interesting just questions there, right? And I think definitely connected to you as an artist and thinking about how do you care for the work that you make too, right? And what is meant to last? And maybe there are things that aren't meant to last.
Right. And in my studio practice, you know, talking about caregiving, just caring for artwork, we talked about that in our earlier conversation, like, there's a lot of archiving that goes into being a studio artist and keeping track of where you sold work to and where it was exhibited. And for me, I have a lot of failed studio work that gets remade into other work and becomes this cycle of sort of translating one project to, you know, and reusing the material in a different project down the line, you know, mm-hmm. which is an interesting, you know, how do you record that?
Yeah.
Something that's somewhat, it's not as linear. You sort of, and that quote earlier, you know, you're coming back, labor maintains, and you kind of have to revisit it. Later in that quote says it's a gesture against change.
Yeah.
This tending.
Coming back to it, I love that. Because you were talking about your studio work and how you approach that, I do think an important part of the conversation is that you have two very kind of distinct components to the art that you do. One being that individual studio work, but then the other being those community-oriented projects like the collective mending sessions, which you mentioned, both of which to me have significantly different approaches, needs, skills. How do you navigate doing both of those things?
Yeah, I sometimes don't navigate them well. they do have really different skills. And I think one important thing I do, no matter if it's in my studio or doing these sort of more collaborative communal work, is I try to follow my intuition and to serve the work. Mm-hmm. When I started the collective mending sessions, I never knew it would sort of transform into these workshops that I'm facilitating and conversation and archiving conversations and oral histories. And those were skills I did not have. Mm-hmm. I did not know how to facilitate group dynamics. We would get into these topics that were very sensitive. I felt like I should have some therapy training or training.
Right, because there becomes like a feeling of responsibility for those stories too.
Yeah, right, exactly. And the stories almost, and the interactions almost became more potent than the actual quilts we were working on.
Mm.
And that was a very uncomfortable place for me, but I had a very strong conviction that I needed to serve the work and to follow it where it was going. So mm-hmm. I just, you know, artists have this, I love this guy named Andrew Simmet. He does tons of artists sort of professional development kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He runs Artist U out of Milwaukee area. And he said that artists have the meta skill of learning new skills. Mm. And I found that to be so true. So especially contemporary artists who are working in a conceptual way that's maybe interdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary, you have this idea, you know, it's like, oh, I want to make 40-foot weavings and I've never woven anything in my life. I'm going to learn
how to weave
yeah. so I can make this specific thing. And so I do that a lot. I've learned also with these two arms of my practice, one very solitary and then one very communal, I navigate them in cycles or seasons.
Sure.
Or plan my studio in quarters. So like this quarter for this 3 months, my word is rest. Mm. Next quarter, it's raise because I need to raise some money for some big steps out, mm. you know, in my artistic, you know, career. And then the next is making. So it'd be a period of art production in my studio, which is a very solitary thing. And I never do the communal and the solitary at the same time because they require such different hats.
Yeah.
And I just can't switch very effectively. Mm-hmm. It's very stressful. And so I've found, and to connect those with the seasons, and, you know, I do more art making when the kids are in school versus in the summer when I'm with them more. You know, so
I love the way of thinking about them as seasons, because I think I would find myself too. I couldn't adjust my brain quickly enough, right, to go back and forth. And so kind of grouping them in seasons, but then also recognizing that seasons are cyclical, right?
Yeah.
It's like so that you'll come back to it.
Right.
And so it almost gives you a time to, like, if you've got this really great, like, community-oriented project, you're like, oh, I'll get to that in that season, right? Mm-hmm. But it gives you the time and space to think about it and plan and prepare for it.
Right.
So that everything can be more intentional. And I think that's a really great way of organizing that.
Yeah. And I've only recently started to do that. And yeah. I've been making art for like 10, 12 years. So it's been a really learning process, because I think for such a long time, when you're a young artist, you just want to say yes to everything,
because yeah.
there's this scarcity thinking that enters in, where you just don't know if you're going to get a chance, right? It's mm-hmm. really hard to get your foot into the door, to get the first grant or the first solo show or the first group show, you know, it's just a lot of work. And so, you know, and not all artists are like me. They're going to mm-hmm. have different energy levels and different working styles. So I found it works well for me.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that too. To just emphasize that this is all a learning process too.
Yeah.
Even going back to the quote, you have some of the skills that artists are building are not just making skills. They're not just creative skills, right?
Yeah.
But they're these organizational ones and time management, and also a word you used in an earlier conversation was discernment. Like, how do I decide
yeah.
where to focus my attention and what is important and where should my energy be put?
That can be really difficult.
Yeah.
And another important part of being an artist is being in artistic communities. And I get a lot of discernment, like I was saying earlier, from my friends who are really good at critique, or they're just really good at editing my terribly written proposal, you know, and just asking really good questions. Like, what does that paragraph even mean that
sure.
you just wrote, you know? So I do think, like, this idea of the standalone artist, just, it's not real.
Yeah.
It's existing in community. And if you don't have that community, it's really isolating, and you really sort of suffer as an artist and get burnt out.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask kind of just like a broad, fun, philosophical question, but when given the freedom to dream, what do you creatively dream about?
I love this question. And I was writing about it before coming here, and I actually hate the word dream.
Yeah.
Because for me, I have a lot of tenacity, and mm-hmm. I like to, like, get stuff done. So I like to check off the boxes. I'm
sure.
one of those really annoying people, but I also love really expansive questions. Like, how can, here's one, another one I am guiding my practice for. How can an individual artist map our collective grief and loss? Mm. Like, how do you even answer that question, right? Yeah. But just asking it sort of expands your mind. And so dreaming for me has in its, I don't know, maybe it's the word or some of my experiences, but it has in it decision-making as well. Mm. So like if you're going to have a dream, then you have to have a plan, then you have to do things, and it seems really intimidating.
Sure.
What I, if I could like replace dream with wonder, mm-hmm. or even wander, that to me feels so good.
Yeah.
You know, this big question, like, I don't know if I have the freedom to wonder. That is so exciting.
Yeah.
That is, I can find connections. I can show people those connections. I can learn about their lives. I can learn about the life of objects and the history of, you know, this tin cup from colonial, I don't know, or, you know, the history of coffee, or, why certain gemstones were used in these jewelers in Africa, or I don't know. It, I just really love to learn, and I love to ask questions and to wonder about things, mm-hmm. and to wander in like an open space.
Yeah.
And to have that freedom, to just see what will happen and the potential for things connecting. That's really exciting. But dreaming to me, I don't know. Maybe it's
it
just,
feels like work. Maybe
it does,
right?
Feel
instead
like
of
work.
Instead of care and tending, just kind of going back to the earlier part of our conversation. I like that a lot. Just because I'm someone who also I've always been drawn to the word wonder, right?
And yeah.
Because it also means you have the space and the time and the
freedom,
the calm, right? And the freedom to be able to do all of that. And those are things that are not always
present.
Easy to access and easy to come by. And so there is something really, you know, you feel it when you're like, oh, I can, I have this space to wonder,
mm-hmm.
or to wander. I think both of those are easily connected. There is a quote that I read just recently from Audre Lorde that I really liked and connected to what we were talking about today and kind of things I think about when I interact with the art that you make and the community work that you do. And she just said that the aim of each thing we do is to make our lives and the lives of our children richer and more possible.
Mm.
And to me, that was a simple quote, but something that I wanted to express to you just as a way of saying thank you for what you contribute to our community and for doing things that I feel, and I know others in our community feel, make our community richer and also engage our children in the work that you're doing. And that as a mother, personally, that is something I am incredibly grateful for in what you provide through your art and through your work to AIMS in our community. So I wanted to say that. And I also want to say thank you, Catherine, for joining us today and having this wonderful conversation. If people want to connect with you or your work, where can they keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, so I have a personal sort of studio website. It's just www.CatherineReinhart.com. And I'm on Instagram too, Catherine_Reinhart_studio. It's very annoying handle. And then also the Collective Mending Sessions, which is my socially engaged project, has a separate website, CollectiveMendingSessions.com, and Collective Mending Sessions on Instagram. And I'm pretty active on those platforms, so.
Great. And I know this month is Mend March. So what do you have planned for this month, or how can people get more involved with that?
Yeah, I'm going to have two in-person workshops that people can attend. One that will be here in Ames, just right down the street, right next to the Octagon at the Creative Commons. And it will be on Thursday, March 30th from 4 to 7 p.m. And you're welcome to come in and stitch on a quilt. And then I'm actually going to be taking the mending sessions to Chicago in March, which is very exciting. With the Roman Susan Art Foundation from Rogers Park, I believe, and they have this series that they call their movement studies, and it's held at the Berger Cultural Center in Chicago, and that's on March 25th, which is a Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. So
great.
Yeah.
I love Chicago. So.
I know. Yeah. Come to Chicago.
Maybe I'll see you there.
Yeah. Great.
All right. Well, thank you again, Catherine, for the wonderful conversation and for all that you contribute to our community.
Well, thanks so much. And this has been really a really great experience. And thanks for thinking of me.
Of course.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening to Articulations, brought to you by the Margaret Sauce Center for Women and Gender Equity and KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. Our interview is edited by Rosie Rowe. Join us next week, Monday at 4 p.m., for a conversation with Sasha Phillips. To round out the hour, we invite you to sit back and enjoy a selection of songs picked by Catherine. You can find the full Articulations playlist on Spotify or on the Sauce Center website.